It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And this week will be a little different from what you're used to. Obviously, there's not a whole lot of fantasy baseball going on right now, be it drafting, transactions, or playing. So we're going to talk a lot of sort of concept, a lot of ideas, a lot of just kind of what we're taking from this postseason so far. And we're going to start with what has been one of the bigger questions really in baseball this postseason, and that's about bullpen use. In the AL wildcard game, Buck Showalter took a lot of heat, and in my mind, rightly so, for the fact that he lost a one-game winner-go-home game without the guy who might have been the best pitcher in the American League, Zach Britton, ever throwing a pitch. Terry Francona's gotten a lot of credit for being very aggressive with his relievers, including another guy who might be the best reliever in the game, Andrew Miller. John Gibbons, Dave Roberts have been way more aggressive with their closers than I think we're used to seeing. There's just basically a lot of guys turning into postseason Joe Torre, postseason Tony La Russa, the way they're handling their bullpens. And so I think you have to at least ask the question, and that is, do you think as we see this in October, there's any chance that this leads to different distribution of innings, of save chances, just basically different bullpen use when the 2017 regular season starts? What do you think, Fred?
I think my guess is not that much, even though I do think the Showalter incident was a bit of a turning point in that the criticism of him not using Britton was basically universal across baseball. Yeah. I really didn't see anyone sticking up for it. You know, there were some writers who said, well, you know, in defense of him, this is what people, managers, are typically thinking in that scenario. But nobody really said he did the right thing. And then it seems like managers have really springboarded off that. And then Francona, obviously, with Miller. And then, as you mentioned, we've really seen, you know, Kenley Jansen throw multiple innings. The Blue Jays bring Roberto Osuna in early in games and then kind of just hope that he can get to the end and be ready if he can't. I don't know, though. Over 162-game regular season, players like patterns. Managers like patterns and uniformity. I still feel like closers are going to pitch the ninth inning or, you know, the last inning of an extra innings game on the road. I don't think this will change it, but it would have a big change in the fantasy landscape if it did change next year. What's your takeaway? I mean, you've been in more locker rooms this postseason by far than I have.
I think we will see a very subtle shift. And what I mean by that is I think from April to mid-August, virtually nothing changes. And in fact, I will not be at all surprised if Andrew Miller is pitching the ninth for Cleveland next year when we come back to spring training. I think for most of the year, it will be very conservative. And that's partly about roles, but it's also about workload. And I think that's one of the things to remember here is that I think one of the cases that a lot of managers will make is, if I only use Kenley Jansen for 65, 70 innings in the regular season, that allows me to push him this hard in October. I think where you will see, where you're likely to see some difference is from, I don't know exactly where it is, I don't think it's August 1st, maybe it's mid-August, maybe it's the beginning of September. I think there is a decent chance you will start seeing this October bullpen usage become, maybe not this extreme, but I think you'll see a little of this deep into pennant race bullpen usage. And we see some of this now, but I think there's a chance you will see more of this, where if you've got a real lockdown guy, and understand that's part of this as well. If you're the Braves, not that the Braves are likely to be in contention, and Jim Johnson is the guy at the back of your bullpen, you're not going to go out of your way to get Jim Johnson 5, 6, 7 outs. But if you've got a Jansen, a Miller, Chapman, one of those guys who is just clearly better, I think there's a chance that this October usage will start becoming August and September usage for teams that are really in a fight to get into the postseason. But I think from a fantasy perspective, those differences are really subtle. I think you just need to look at specific guys. And I think the real question will be Miller. I think from a fantasy perspective, the biggest question, and I think you'll have to watch this, because I won't be surprised if they use him as a before the ninth guy, but I also won't be surprised if he moves into the ninth next year. He's the one guy that I think is an open question exactly what kind of usage he gets next year.
Yeah, Miller to me, I felt like just watching this postseason, like Miller maybe is cementing his status as not the closer, assuming that they have Cody Allen next season, that maybe Miller's, he's been so incredibly valuable in earlier innings. And I know they're not going to use him to pitch, you know, two and two plus innings at a time during the regular season, but his ability to come in one inning and quickly put out a fire and then maybe pitch the next inning and still throw 20 pitches or less, which is what it takes, you know, many relievers to do in one inning. He's just proven to be so incredibly valuable that I'll be very interested to see their approach with him next year, but I feel like he's almost proven to be so valuable with a flexible role that it might keep him out of the ninth inning. And then I wondered if any other manager will look at their own bullpen and say, well, I have this Cody Allen-level pitcher, you know, who I can use in the ninth, and I have this other even better pitcher who I can use in earlier innings. I mean, the Yankees have had a lot of value from using Betances in earlier innings in recent seasons. The real issue is, though, not a lot of teams are going to have two relievers
right
at that level. So, and then managers are probably going to revert back to just using the really good
right
one to close out games. There'll only be a few bullpens where it'll matter.
Right, and that's the thing. I think, you know, as somebody who has been screaming for rational bullpen usage for years, I'm sure you've seen this. I think most of us who kind of wish we'd stop managing to a stat, that's kind of, I think, what we've all known it was going to take. I think we've all known that if we were going to see a team manage its bullpen in a way where you get your best pitcher really high leverage innings, that's exactly what it was going to take, was that combination of one guy who was so ridiculously good that you started saying, we have to use this guy at the biggest point in the game, and somebody else who is reliable enough that you trust them in the ninth. And when you get to that, I think that's when you can start seeing that happen. But again, there aren't many situations where you'll see that. I think, I don't know on Miller. I'm open to both possibilities. I'm just saying, I would, in any rating of him, bake in at least some possibility that when they go to spring training next year, they say, you know what, we want to make sure we have this guy in October. We're going to give him 60 innings. We're going to give him clean innings, and we're going to funnel things to him. I won't be surprised if they don't do that, but I think there's also a chance they do that.
Yeah, and they might choose to just be really flexible and say,
yeah,
at the end of the year, Allen gets 25 saves and Miller gets 15,
yeah,
and they just play,
yeah,
matchups late in the innings, because they have both walked the walk on their talk. When the trade was made, they talked the talk on how they were both unselfish players who would do whatever to help the team win, and they've walked the walk on that, and we've seen it all the way now through the postseason.
Yep, absolutely. And, of course, let's be completely open to the possibility that one other option is, when you have that much strength in one area, it is possible that you could deal from that strength to upgrade somewhere else. So I'm not saying that will happen. I do think it's a possibility. Aside from bullpen use, possibly the other biggest story of this postseason has been Javier Baez, who is a tremendously entertaining player to watch, who was pretty productive this year, but not a guy you found yourself saying, I have to have him. I can't help thinking of Rougned Odor last postseason. Kind of a similar player in some ways, just in that the talent is just so obvious and the consistency isn't always there. And you can see what he can be, but he's not quite that yet. And so I sort of wonder, is Odor kind of an instructive guy to think about as we think about Baez in fantasy drafts in 2017.
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison, in the sense that, you know, they both have power, they both have speed, neither player walks a lot. They're both maybe more exciting and more of a fantasy asset than a real-life asset, even though both were obviously, yeah, really good in the postseason, you know, Odor last year and Baez this year. I think for Baez, it's just going to be role next year. And, you know, I mean, he appeared in 142 games this year, which, you know, indicates everyday player, but his plate appearances were 450, which doesn't totally indicate everyday player. So, I mean, he's coming in later in games, pinch hitting and so on. You know, is he going to get 600 plate appearances next season? I think that's really the big question for him. It's hard to see, without them moving pieces, like exactly where that happens. He's had, I think, four starts at second and four starts at shortstop in the playoffs or in the postseason. But I don't know where he fits as an everyday player next year.
I mean, I think one of the things about a guy like him with that kind of ability is that if he produces, he'll play. I mean, I think we know that, and I think we know that about the Cubs, that if this guy is good enough, he will play. And so to me, one of the big questions is, and you know, if you make that Odor comparison, Odor hit 33 home runs this year after 16 last year. He is younger than Baez. He was actually younger this year in his follow-up season than Baez was in his breakout season. But to me, the question on Odor is he had 14 home runs this year, 12 steals. I don't see him as a 30-steal guy. I see him as somewhere in there, 15 steals, maybe 20. You know, I don't think anybody thinks he's going to be a 300 to 320 hitter with the strike zone judgment he has. So the question is beyond playing time, and that obviously is a question. But again, I think if he performs, he will play. The question is, for a guy who once hit 37 home runs in a major league season, do you see him taking that kind of leap with the power? Do you see him as a north of 25 home runs guy in 2017? Because that, to me, is what really determines just how valuable he is next year.
Yeah, I feel like 25 is maybe a good place to set the bar. I don't know if I'm ready to take the over on that. He may be someone who gets overdrafted, you know, or drafted too early next season just based on the postseason heroics. Like, we'll see how the rest of this all plays out. But if he has additional moments, you know, he could be someone who gets drafted too early. I feel like 25 is probably a nice spot. Like I said, I don't think I would totally take the over on that. And I think you're right with the steals. Like, double digits, I wouldn't go to 20. Joe Maddon's been, like, kind of all over the place with steals. You know, like, we saw Rizzo, you know, steal bases last season and not really steal bases this season. Like, with his green light, they've kind of been all over the place. So I'm not willing to project 20 steals with him, but I think 10 to 15 is fine.
Jose Bautista was certainly not bad in the postseason and not bad in the regular season, but he was not this year either in the regular season or in the postseason, the guy that we have gotten used to seeing in recent years. He hit 234 this year. He hit 22 home runs and didn't play a lot, but 517 plate appearances. So even with the number of games missed, he just wasn't quite the same guy this year, capable of tremendous hot streaks. But Bautista is just turned 36.
Yeah.
He is...
Yeah, he turned 36 on the day of their last game.
Yeah, and he is hoping to get a whole lot of money, and he will play next year. How do you look at Bautista? I don't want to put too much into the postseason, except that it kind of ties into a lot of what we saw in the regular season, that he doesn't seem to be the same six-month guy that he was a couple of years ago. How do you look at him going into 17?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the big question with him, and, you know, we can't really know this answer, you know, did he ever get back to full health after those injuries he suffered in the summer? Like, he was going along not bad, not great in the first half of the season, and then he had the toe injury and the knee injury, you know, kind of one on top of each other, and he was back after that, but not especially effective. I think that's real. So was he ever healthy down the stretch, or is this a decline? And I don't think we're going to really know the answer until we get partway into next season, whether he stays with the Blue Jays or goes to another team. If he was still, you know, didn't have as much power as he wanted in his lower half because of those injuries, you know, he comes right back maybe to being a 35 home run player next year. If this is just a decline for him, then he doesn't. I think you have to bake some of that concern into your projections for him for next year and probably project something like, you know, 30 home runs, maybe 85 or 90 RBIs, not 35 to 40 and 100. Do you think I'm kind of on the right track there?
I think that's reasonable. And I think the other question I have about him, and I do want to acknowledge up front, he is not a guy who has historically had really extreme home road splits. He's not a guy who has only hit in Toronto. But I think it's pretty clear that whatever the reasons are, being a member of the Blue Jays as a power hitter is a really good position to be in, whether they have really good scouting of opposing pitchers, whether it's just being in that lineup, whether it's coaching, whether, you know, whether it's the man in white, you know, whatever it is, it's pretty clear that that's a good situation. If you are a power hitter, being in Toronto is a good thing. How much, when you assess Bautista, and let's tie Encarnacion into this as well, because it's the same question, how much will the ball club weigh in, will where they go weigh in? And I'm not just talking about if these guys go to Seattle or Anaheim or someplace that's tough to hit, just generally the situation, how much will you weigh that with both Bautista and Encarnacion when assessing them for 2017?
Yeah, I think if they stay in, you know, good situations, if they end up on, you know, Boston or Baltimore or something like that, then I think I'm okay with it. I mean, they've been so good for so many years now with Toronto that I feel like, you know, we can trust that this is something they could carry forward to a new team. And as you mentioned, neither of them have dramatic home road splits during their time with the Blue Jays. So, you know, so I'm not too worried about that. If they went to, you know, like you said, a Seattle, the Angels, something like that, then I would be more concerned. I don't believe they're really great fits for the National League. Encarnacion played first base fine down the stretch, but on a 4 or 5 year contract, I don't know if a National League team wants to take that on. And Bautista struggled in the outfield. I feel like a team that has the DH available to them will probably sign him. So I'm not too worried about their free agent destination until I see it. I'm not worried. I mean, obviously, I feel pretty good about Encarnacion right now because he had such a nice season. With Bautista, and this is now me kind of taking my stat head hat off and just having watched him play every day down the stretch, he had a lot of hits that were his classic Bautista. His classic swing is he's got a beautiful classic swing that puts the ball right up the third baseline for a home run. And he had a lot of swings down the stretch where he did that swing, hit the ball in the exact spot where you would expect him to hit a home run, and he flew out. And I don't know if that's an injury and a little bit of lack of power, like I mentioned earlier, from his lower half, and he's just not quite getting everything on the ball, or if it was a timing thing, I don't know. But he had a lot of hits down the stretch, and some of them were in the postseason where when he hit the ball, it looked exactly like it looks when he hits home runs over the years, and then it was just a fly out, even at Rogers Center, where it's a pretty good spot to hit homers. So I'm going to watch the free agent destination, but for Bautista specifically, my concern is health.
Raise a really interesting question. Corey Seager is pretty indisputably a great baseball player. You take the total package, ability to hit for average, a pretty decent strike zone, power, pretty good shortstop. That's a really good player. But in fantasy in 2017, you raised the question of whether he might not be quite elite in fantasy. He drove in 72 runs this year. He did score 105. 26 home runs at shortstop is something that a few years ago would have made you almost an automatic first-round pick, but as we've discussed here before, it's not quite so cut and dried anymore. Shortstop is really deep, and I think the sort of fundamental question at the center of your question is Corey Seager the kind of player who is a better baseball player than fantasy player? And I'm not sure he is. I like him a lot going in the next year in that lineup with his skill set. I like him a lot, but I think it's a fair question. Where do you come down as you sort of turn that over in your head? Where do you come down on Seager?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with Seager. Is I think we all like Seager. You know, anyone who watches baseball recognizes that he's one of the best young players in the game. But assessing him for fantasy, which is what we need to do, I mean, in our first mock draft for 2017, you know, over at our site, he went 11th. That's in the first round. He went 11th overall, and I was surprised to see that because I feel like there isn't really stolen base potential with him. I mean, he stole 3 bases this year on 6 attempts. I would be hard-pressed to project him for more than 5 steals next year. I mean, he's a 300 hitter who could hit 30 home runs next year. I feel like you have to be able to project close to 100 RBIs to put him in that first-round conversation. I just feel like people are automatically talking about him as a lock, as a first- or second-round pick next year. And I'm not totally sure where that's coming from when he was, he was barely a top-10 shortstop this year, and I don't see stolen base growth coming. So the growth, and I can't really see batting average growth when he hit 308 this year, not significant batting average growth. So the growth would have to come in homers and RBIs, and I can't say for sure that's going to happen. I mean, in my head, it's a debate between, for example, him and Trevor Story. Like, Trevor Story was on pace to hit 40 home runs this year before he was injured. He plays in Colorado. He's going to play there again next year. I feel like to a lot of people, the gap between Seager and Story when the draft rankings come out is going to be massive, and I'm not sure if it should be.
I think that's definitely fair. Here's the one thing on Seager, and I think this is likely. If I tell you that he hits third or fourth for the Dodgers next year instead of in a table-setting position, how does that change your outlook?
Yeah, it does. I mean, and he did score 100 runs this season, 105 to be exact, and he only drove in 72. If he hits third all of next year, and he drives in 90 runs, maybe 95 runs, then you know, then I could see him maybe more as a second-round pick. To me, he's a safe pick for sure because I don't see him having a fall-off, you know, in his second full season next year. But I'm just not sure. Like, is he should he be drafted ahead of Carlos Correa? I don't know. I mean, Carlos Correa was a first-round pick in a lot of leagues this year. He's still really young. He's still really talented. I think that's going to happen, though, in every league next year.
And to me, that you hit on the difference between him and, say, Story in particular, is that the floor on Seager, I think, is really, really high. And just based on the fact that, to some extent, Story kind of came out of nowhere, I'm not at all convinced, even with him in Colorado, coming off an injury with less of a pedigree, I'm not convinced that the floor on Story is anywhere near as high as the floor on Seager. And so, to some extent, it's kind of a risk tolerance thing, because I do agree that the ceiling on Story as a fantasy player is higher, without doubt. So it's sort of a question of whether you want the sort of narrower band and the safer pick, or the guy who could just absolutely go insane and win you your league for you.
I think that's a good point. How about this comparison? You know, Seager versus Trey Turner next year.
I mean, I think it's the same kind of thing, because I think you've got to ask yourself, do you trust the power on Turner? Because if you trust the power, he's a first-round ability kind of guy. If you trust the power, to me, the parallel to Turner is Mookie Betts. From the number of ways he can help you, the number of things he can do, if you honestly believe that based on his power in this part season this year, that he's a 25-home-run kind of guy with the steals he can have, with the average, the ceiling on Turner, to me, as a fantasy player, is as high as absolutely any player in the game. It's just a question of, do you believe he gets there? How likely do you think it is that Turner reaches or even comes close to what I think his ceiling is next year?
I think it's quite possible. And actually, when I was thinking about Turner, I was comparing him in my mind to Jose Altuve, kind of maybe circa 2015. So 2015
right.
is 15 homers, 38 steals, .313 batting average. I mean, if he could do that, and I mean, in 2015, Altuve, who everybody was quite happy with in 2015, had 86 runs and 66 RBIs. Turner could beat those, those counting stats. So, and it maybe even as good or, like, maybe not quite the batting average, but as good or better in the steals as Altuve, stealing 30 this past season, and maybe he could match the 24 homers, the 108 runs. So, yeah, I think that's the big thing. Like, we've thrown out, like, now a lot of names in comparison to Seager, so I just want to raise that doubt maybe with some people to think about him critically and not think about what a terrific asset he is for the Dodgers, but what his real fantasy potential is for next year.
Yeah. We now move to talk about a couple of Red Sox. I think it's fair to say that in Boston, the end of the season was quite a disappointment. That was a team that I and a lot of people probably liked the best in the American League. My tears coming into the postseason, I think we talked about this, were Cubs, Red Sox, Dodgers, and then maybe Blue Jays, and the Red Sox were done very quickly. Part of them being done very quickly was David Price with another rough postseason start. Now, that doesn't figure into fantasy really, but it's sort of a tag on what was a hard-to-figure year for Price. He, in most of the second half, looked like the guy that people hoped he would be, but on the whole, it was not a great season. He didn't look great in his postseason start. How high do you have Price going into 17?
Yeah, I think I'm still optimistic enough to say low-end ace, so maybe around 10th or 12th, 5th or so starting pitcher. To me, he's somebody you consider in the top 5 or 6. Really interesting stat line for him this year. Like, he ate a ton of innings. He won 17 games. His strikeout rate in the first half was awesome, but his ERA wasn't. His ERA was 3.58 in the second half, which is fine, but not really ace-like. And his strikeout rate dropped in the second half, so you weren't getting the strikeouts as much anymore. Month to month, his ratios were all over the place. So I think I like him maybe 12th or something among starters, and it's early days for putting together rankings, but maybe something like 12th, where you can count on a really nice strikeout total, plenty of wins, but you're not really sure if you're going to get the low 3 or the high 3 ERA.
I think that's fair. I think it's not a bad place to be, and he's the kind of guy where, and I mean, look, to some extent, this is everybody, I realize it's kind of an empty statement, but he's the kind of guy where I am not going to rush to get him. I'm okay with somebody else gets him, if somebody else gets him. But if he falls to me a little lower than maybe I expected, I will be really excited. He's a guy where if I got him 5-10 picks later than I expected, I would think, oh, yeah, this is very good. So,
yeah, he could be a really nice boomer bust pick for people who don't get one of those top five, the Scherzer, the Sale, the Bumgarner, the people who miss out on them or choose not to take them, wait a couple rounds. You know, he's that boomer bust guy where he could get you 235 strikeouts and a low 3 ZRA and win 20 games next year. There's risk with him, but there's a lot of reward there.
Yeah, and I also really love to have him as my second starter. If you kind of broke that way, you know, that's the kind of guy you'd love to have where you're going to get those counting stats, you're going to get those strikeouts, you're going to get those wins, and there's a possibility that you get something else really exciting there in the possibility of the ratios.
Yeah, and I could see that also, in a 10-team league. You know what I mean? In a 10-team league, I could see that where you wait on starters and maybe you take him and someone else back-to-back that you like, and you say, well, I skipped the Kershaws and the Scherzers, but I got Price and another pitcher that I really like.
Yep. Also with the Red Sox, another guy who kind of ended with a whimper and a guy who was kind of hard to figure all year, for better and worse. Jackie Bradley Jr. did a lot of things to really like. I think one of the exciting things about him is that over the course of a full year, he showed more of a strike zone than he's had in the past. And on the year, you know, there are a lot of things to like, but also this is an outfielder who hit .267 and stole 9 bases. So 26 homers, 87 RBI, 94 runs, those things are very nice. But on balance, what do we do with Bradley? Was this a breakout? Was this a stepping stone to a next year? Was it a hot 2 months for a guy who overall is a pretty good player? What do you do with Bradley?
Yeah, I could see Bradley being maybe overrated next season, and it falls into that classic observation where a really good first half can mask, you know, a below average or average second half. I mean, he stole 2 bases after the beginning of July. I feel like, and I mean, he didn't hit for average in the second half. I feel like maybe he's established himself as a like mid-20s home run hitter. I feel like maybe we can bank on that now. I'm just not sure what, and in the Red Sox lineup, if you hit 25 home runs, you know, you're going to get your fair share of runs and RBIs. I'm just not sure if we can count on more than a single-digit steals total and a batting average that doesn't help or hurt you. And in a mixed league, that makes him, you know, kind of fine as like your fourth outfielder or something like that, but not someone that you chase in a draft, kind of someone that you take in the second half of the draft if you have a need for a power-hitting outfielder or maybe kind of an all-around outfielder with a little more power lean, and he's still available. But I'm not sure if he's someone that you chase in drafts, which is kind of where a lot of people, I think, were at with him at the All-Star break and maybe didn't notice the second half as much.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fair. And I mean, I think the one thing at this point about Bradley is that he's at least established he's going to play. You know, he's between the power and the defense, he's going to play. He's no longer a guy where you worry about, is he going to lose his job? He's not going to lose his job. He'll play.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think maybe he's moved out of that, like he's going to hit eighth or ninth in the lineup. I mean, he logged his most plate appearances this year hitting 6th, and that's a good spot in a good Red Sox lineup. So that was one of my concerns with him earlier in the season, was just that he hit 8th or 9th all season, and that hasn't happened. Yeah. So I think that's a nice, gives him, I think he's maybe a fairly high floor with him.
Yeah. Anthony Rizzo has 10 hits and 1 home run and 4 RBI in 13 postseason games. That follows a second half where he was good, but not what he was in the first half. Rizzo had 21 homers in 85 games, followed by 11 in 70 games. You know, the overall numbers look like this is one of those very consistent, very reliable, you know what you're going to get, a little bit like Adrian Gonzalez was a few years ago before his power started to wane. But between a fairly quiet October and a certainly not bad, but relatively quiet second half, how high are you on Rizzo going into 17?
Yeah, a lot of people were really high on him this year in drafts, and he was going like mid-first round. I think that maybe was a little too optimistic. I really like, you know, someone in the heart of that Cubs lineup because it's going to be good again next season. But I think maybe he's kind of going to settle in as like in the heart of that lineup as a high floor hitter, but not someone who's going to win you your league. So maybe not a top 10 pick, more like like an on the turn in a 12-team league, yep. or you know, or a second round in a 10-team league, or that kind of thing. Maybe you're on the turn in a 15-team league. That kind of hitter, even though he and Corey Seager, who we've already discussed, are totally different careers, points in their career right now, maybe very similar. With a high floor, you're going to get solid power, you know, plenty of counting stats and a solid batting average, but you're not going, unless the steals come back, you're not going to get steals. Not as big of a deal for Rizzo since he's a first baseman, but I don't know if I'm feeling like a 40 home run, 120 RBI season at any point in Rizzo's future.
That's pretty much exactly where I am with him, except for one thing. I'm not sure that he needs to hit 40 to drive in 120. I mean, that to me, the one thing about Rizzo is that in that lineup, with the number of base hits that he gets, with even good power rather than great power, I don't find it difficult at all to see him driving in north of 110, just based on the lineup they're going to put out there, his durability and his ability to both get base hits and home runs. But still, overall, I'm with you. To me, he's a 290, 30, 100, 100 guy. That's a really good player, but it's not a top 10 pick player to me.
Yeah, I think he could be a great way to start your team if you paired him with a Trey Turner or something, you know,
yeah.
late first, early second. I think that's great. I just think maybe, for example, like this season, he was going before Chris Bryant in drafts. I don't see that them as even really debatable now.
No, and it's, you know, again, that it's sort of that floor versus ceiling thing. Bryant's ceiling is just ridiculous. Like he's a guy who, if he hit 45 next year, it wouldn't really be shocking. You wouldn't bet on that from anybody. I mean, that's so hard to do at this point that you don't expect it. But if he does, you wouldn't be shocked.
That's right. I think even though Rizzo had the 17 steal season in 2015, I feel more confident that Bryant, you know, Bryant has a 13 and an 8 so far. I feel more confident that I'll get about 10 steals from Bryant, which does matter right now with steals being at such a premium. And I don't really feel that way with Rizzo. And maybe that's just a gut feeling, but I feel like Rizzo's, you know, 5 steals or less next year.
No, I definitely agree. I won't be surprised at all if we've seen Anthony Rizzo's last season of north of about 5 steals.
Yeah.
One last postseason related topic before we sign off here this week. The Mets, coming into this year, looked like they had a rotation full of guys that they would want on their mound and that you would want on your team. That rotation didn't come out all that great. A ton of injuries. Zach Wheeler, who people were excited about, never made it back. Syndergaard was very good but battled some injuries and wasn't quite what he was the first 2 months. I mean, let's start with Syndergaard because I think he's still kind of an interesting question. I can't shake some – this is a guy who is going to get serious Cy Young votes, and yet I can't shake some degree of disappointment over him. Do you think that he kind of repeats 16? Do you think there's more there? Do you worry about the health risk? How do you kind of put a dossier on Syndergaard going into next year?
I do worry about the health risks and, you know, really not statistically backing that up, but he throws really hard and
yep.
we already had the little elbow scare in the middle of the season. And I do worry about the health risk. To me, that's the big concern for him. I'd love to see him clean up his ability to stop base stealers. I do think that will catch up with him and has a little bit already, but I mean, a 260 ERA, you're right. Like we're both pausing on him at his age after a 260 ERA and 218 strikeouts. We should say full steam ahead. This guy's a top five starter for next year for sure. But you look back and you see 183 and two thirds innings. And he was healthy or pretty healthy all season. I don't know. I'm not ready to go to a 200 inning projection for him yet. And that keeps him now to the back end of the aces.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But a really exciting back end ace. Like when you're talking about how you feel about David Price, like if 7 or 8 starters are gone and then you get Syndergaard, I don't know where he'll end up in the ADP next spring, but if 7 or 8 starters are gone and you get Syndergaard, you'd have to be pretty excited.
Yeah, for sure. The next tier with Mets starters is DeGrom and Matt, two guys who were very good when they pitched and missed a lot of time. I can't shake some worry about DeGrom. I can't shake some worry about him getting back to what he was, only because he kind of came out of nowhere when he arrived. And so it just feels like a lot had to go right. He was so good, but I can't shake that feeling that so much had to go right for him to become that guy, that if he loses even a little, maybe he's not that guy anymore. I'd probably let somebody else take DeGrom, and I might get a little aggressive on Matt just because I think the upside is so high. I'm not even saying I'd take DeGrom before Matt, because I think I would take DeGrom before Matt. But, like, if those were my two options, I'd take DeGrom. But I feel like I'd rather let somebody else take the risk on DeGrom, wait a little while, and be the one who takes the risk on Matt. How do you see those two guys?
Yeah, both, like, really high risk, high reward. I think I worry about the future DL stint more with Matt, because he seems to be building a resume as someone who can't stay healthy. Yeah. We'll see about that, but...
And he was that in the minors.
That's what I mean, yeah, like going all the way back to his minor league days, is someone maybe who's just brittle. And some players, you know, both position players and pitchers, can just be a little brittle. It doesn't mean he isn't tough and works hard. Some people are a little more brittle than others. So I worry about that. I know what you mean. I'm a little less injury concerned with DeGrom, but you're right. I have some performance kind of concerns. And, I mean, everything he's done in the majors has been really good. Even this year, a 3.04 ERA, totally good this year. But we have seen with many other pitchers, you know, I mean, look at Dallas Keuchel and Sonny Gray this year, coming off great seasons, had minor, like, it was the shoulder later in the season with Keuchel, and Gray had some issues, but the drop was enormous. Like, it was from, you know, great ERAs to terrible ERAs, and you're right, I could see that happening with DeGrom. So I feel like when you put that all together, maybe you want them as your number three or four starter in a mixed league. I don't even know if you want DeGrom as your number two. Like, would you feel comfortable with that?
No, I'd be worried. I think this is so much of this. It's a little like playing cards in that you're picking the players, but you're really sort of going against the knowledge of the other people you're with. You know, it's all relative. And so relatively, I am down on DeGrom compared to what I think other people I'm playing with will be. And relatively, I think I'm up on Matt's relative to other. I have more confidence that Matt's will be healthy or good, excuse me, hurt or good and not anything else than I do DeGrom. DeGrom, I could see him falling some and being healthy. I think Matt's is going to be either really good or on the DL. And I'd rather have that a little later than be disappointed with performance in DeGrom. And look, I hope I'm wrong. I love watching DeGrom. It wouldn't shock me if he's really, really good. I just can't get it out of the back of my head that that fade risk scares me a lot, and I can't even justify it. It's kind of a gut feeling, like you said.
It's a really good point, because with pitchers, I mean, two out of the four categories where a starting pitcher can help you are ratio-based categories. So, I mean, as much as you would be frustrated if you got 18 good starts out of Steven Matz next year and then he spent a lot of time on the disabled list, you'd be frustrated about that, but it's better than having a pitcher in your lineup who posts a 5.5 ERA during April and May and then goes on the DL, or, you know, then straightens out, but he's really ruined your ratios in that time. I mean, because the pitchers are so ratio-dependent, you'd almost, even though it's frustrating when they go on the DL, you'd almost rather have them pitch well and go on the DL then sit in your lineup. And that's what happened with Keuchel and Sonny Gray for a lot of owners this year. They sat in your lineup the first few months, ruining your ratios, and, you know, and then you find out about little nagging injuries later. So, yeah, I could see that. I think you need to get in a position maybe for both of them where you already have a couple starters before you even consider them, and then you can say, okay, well, now I don't even have to start him. If he has a bad start, I'll just leave him on my bench and see where we go from there. That, I think that's where you need to be.
Yep. And then one last Mets starter question, and then we will wrap this up. Harvey or Wheeler, either one of them on your radar as a guy that you would draft before spring training?
If I was drafting now in a league that actually counted for next year, sure. In the later rounds, I would take one of them, because I think when you get to opening day, you'll either be in a position with either one of them where you are happy you drafted them or you just drop them and pick someone else up, and over that amount of time, a lot of other options would have emerged. So I would take them over just a really blah starter in the last round, who I'm pretty sure will be healthy next year, but isn't really going to do much for me. And then as far as assessing them as for like March drafts, like I think they're just the big, some of the biggest variables out there. We could be really excited about them by March, or we could have actually physically scratched them off the draft list.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Dinky, for taking the time to talk.